Welcome to the Cosmic Eye Show, where we explore spiritual ideas and books that help you live a better life. Hosted by spiritual teacher and author of If You Can Worry, You Can Meditate, Jason Napolitano.
All right. Hello. Welcome to the Cosmic Eye Show. I am your host, Jason Napolitano, and online and on the video today, I have my co-host, Mr. Chris Sheridan. How are you doing, Chris?
I'm doing great. It's good to be here. Looking forward to this one for quite a while.
Awesome. I think this is going to be a great show today. So what we're covering today is the 50th anniversary of the moon landing, the Apollo mission to the moon, in light of the ancient wisdom and in light of the symbolic understanding that we might have of that today. We're going to look at some different symbolism and Greek mythology that's associated with that. We're also going to try to look a little bit at the 1950s and 1960s and some of the differences between those eras if we get a chance. As I said, Greek mythology, symbolism, and so on that plays into this is also going to be a part of it. So it's going to be a fun show today. Chris is actually going to helm this one because he is much more of a space and astronomy buff than I am and much better suited to it. So I will hand it over to him in a second. I want to thank all of our listeners to the podcast, the Cosmic Eye podcast at anchor.fm/Cosmic Eye. And I also want to thank our supporters who are supporting us monthly with their donations. And if you can, please do so. Chris is the author of The Spirit in the Sky, and I am the author of If You Can Worry, You Can Meditate. And we are here every Sunday with a new esoteric video. We go into all kinds of different subjects, psychology, mythology, and so forth. And we are called Cosmic Eye. We're looking at things from a cosmic eye perspective. And we're trying to share the ancient wisdom with the modern world. I didn't mean to rip off your idea, but that is what we're doing. So anyway, Chris, take it away and take us into space.
I'm just the guy to do it, I guess. I'm the resident space cadet here. So I remember, actually, this time, the space race, the 60s, growing up during that time. My brother and I would watch Star Trek, which ran from 66 to 69, the original TV series. Lost in Space was already out. So there was just a huge cultural interest, not only in what was happening with NASA and everything, but you know, in space in general. It had really taken over, certainly this country and probably quite a bit of the world too, because it was also in the context of the Cold War, and it really became this space race. But as a kid, it was just neat. It was like, we're doing this, we're doing that. And then I knew they were going to the moon. And I remember being woken up very early in the morning or late at night, I'm not sure which, when I was five, to actually watch on TV Neil Armstrong setting a foot on the moon on July 20th, 1969. So as we are now in the 50th anniversary sequence, again, there's a lot of interest. We have the SpaceX sending rockets up. There's interest in Mars now, exploration, a whole new generation of people learning about the Apollo mission and what was involved. So this is a really good time to talk about this again. And as you said, definitely shine the light of ancient wisdom, because and we'll start to get into this about NASA. They use symbolism quite heavily in the mission patches and insignia. And of course, the moon itself is just such a loaded topic. It's been with us as long as recorded history has been around, and there have been very interesting and very deep connections to the human experience with the moon as a celestial object. So so with that, maybe we can, as far before we get into a little more about the actual mission itself, let me just talk about the moon and how it has affected us culturally for thousands and thousands of years. You want to jump in with there with that?
Sure. I mean, I think in terms of the moon's symbolism, I mean, one of the things that we recognize in the moon is that it's, first of all, a receptive sort of a symbol, in that it's reflective of the sun. And I think that's one of the kind of major symbolisms of it. And that's probably why it was associated with a more feminine aspect, or the idea of water being a reflective surface, like like the moon. Also, obviously, the lunar cycles, female reproductive cycles, the correspondence between those two things. And the ancients obviously were much closer to nature than we were and saw the moon's effect on the tides and on the seasons and on the growing and fecundity of the earth and the planting cycles and so on. And while tied to the sun as well, the moon was a sort of more, a more definitive sort of predictor of what was happening. In other words, the moon's changing face, its surface is a sort of a measurement of time that you can see, whereas the sun itself goes up and down, but it doesn't change. You know, and I say up and down, relatively speaking, obviously, from where we're sitting and seeing it, it looks like it's going up and down. But the point is that the sun itself is a constant symbol. It's ever shining. It does disappear and come back, but the moon appears to change. And I think that's another one of, it's a little more connected to the actual cycles of the earth itself. And it seems more, step down and kind of more human to us, I think, in a way, which is probably why the moon was used as the earliest type of calendar. They used the lunar calendar
before right, they used a solar calendar, right? 28 days and 13 months.
Yeah. And I think a lot of, actually in Islam, they still use the lunar calendar for Judaism as well, for the liturgical calendar. And of course, in the earth religions and the neo-pagan movements and so forth, they use the lunar calendar as well. So it's definitely connected to something spiritual and something symbolic. And I think that something that's more connected to the earth maybe than the sun, although we recognize the sun as the source of all light and all life, it seems somewhat remote. And the moon seems a little closer to us, I think, and a little more, I don't know, for lack of a better word, human in essence. So there's a few thoughts on the moon, and we'll get into more as we go along and, you know, contextualize it with the different things we talk about. But that's a little bit about the moon.
Well, what I'm hearing really is this strong connection, not only with humans to the moon being closer, but also the relationship between the sun and the moon, how just even physically in size, they're roughly the same, well, just about identically the same relative size, because when we have a total solar eclipse, the moon just exactly covers the disk of the sun. So there's this connection between the two. And I think Mayna Halt stated something very similar, that the ancients understood that the sun was stronger in so many ways, you know, more heat, more light than the moon, but also that the moon was somehow nearer to us. And of course, astronomically, we know that it's physically actually closer to us, but also nearer to us in the sense that, yes, it's not this, you know, removed, almost like the God aspect. Mm-hmm. The Father God, the Sky God, he's out there somewhere. He's really strong and really powerful, but he's out there. And then having the goddess, relating to the Earth, being much closer in proximity and effect, as well as more part of our daily and I guess monthly. Look at the moon.
Sure.
It was many moons ago. You're talking about the calendar time. So. But this relationship between the sun and the moon really shows up in a lot of alchemical traditions. It's hermetic in a lot of sense, the hermetic sure. marriage being the union of the sun and the moon. It's also seen as the opposites, maybe like in the East, yin and yang are mm-hmm. considered these, light and dark opposites that are very deeply connected. And it's this, the gold of the sun and the silver. And
the silver of the moon. Yeah, of the exactly. Moon.
That's the alchemical.
And that's actually an interesting point you bring up there, because speaking of the sort of twin aspects of it and tying into Apollo, Apollo is a type of a sun god. He was associated with the sun as time went on.
And, which is a good point, because I've always, once I started to understand mythology, it's like, mm-hmm. well, geez, why pick a sun god to go visit the moon? So,
well, it's interesting because his twin sister is Artemis, otherwise known as Diana in the Roman mythology, and she's actually associated with the moon, and they're twins. their father was Zeus and their mother was Leto, who was a Titan. So even the Greeks saw, you know, the connection between the sun and the moon and this sort of twin aspects to them, you know, many, many, many years ago. So, you know, that's an interesting connection. And I think you were talking about it earlier before the show, you know, how the sun and the moon seem so much more immediate to us. I mean, the ancients had a conception of seven planets, and the sun and moon were included. They had the five other visible planets. But I think the immediacy and the connection to the Earth with the sun and the moon were so obvious that, you know, they had to be thought of as something special. And I think that's why, you know, we talked about this a little bit in our solar mythology podcast that we did. And we talked a little bit about the sun and its importance in mythology and symbolism. But those two planets seem much more immediate and I think sort of relevant to life on Earth. And it was very apparent. And it's apparent today. I mean, you walk outside and the sun gives you light and the moon gives you light by night. And you can see the connection to the seasons. And you can see how the sun is, you know, is the father of life in terms of plant life. And, you know, we need that. And the moon itself seems associated with, you know, blood and motion and movement and water and everything that, you know, everything else that's needed. And those two things are, you know, equal in value and work together for life on the planet. And I think that was not lost on the ancients, obviously. So, and not, I, you know, in some ways, maybe not lost on the name, the, you know, the people who are naming this mission, Apollo. It does seem kind of odd, but then you start thinking about some of the connections and perhaps it was a perfect name. Symbolically,
we talked about the relationship between Apollo and Artemis, his twin sister, in the and I can put up an image in the video, the I guess mission patch for the entire Apollo program shows you know, there's a sun and, or no, I'm sorry, there's the moon and the Earth and this kind of swishing rocket, you know, connecting, leaving the Earth and going to the moon. But on the moon face, you can actually see, like you would on the head of a coin, an outline of, I would assume, Apollo in there. So having the Apollo face on the moon, so you're actually really putting the sun on the moon with this symbolism, but then being the twin sister, or the moon, you know, Artemis being the twin sister to Apollo, just brings, you know, they had to have known something. And one thing to keep in mind when it comes to symbolism used for corporate logos or movie posters or space mission patches or agencies or things like that, yes, there's probably a lot to it. A lot of these people do understand symbolism. If nothing else, maybe the graphic design department knows a little something or just thinks they look cool, like a rock band logo. But they're also archetypal images. So even if you don't deliberately, you know, contrive something, if you're will might just pop out for you.
And they speak to us on a level that, you know, is unconscious. It's below the level of our normal consciousness. So why we choose what we choose and how it's related to the, you know, the meaning of those symbols that goes beyond like what our conscious knowledge is of them is definitely powerful. And that's the kind of thing, like when they talk about subliminal advertising or they talk, you know, they use symbolism and archetypal messages and advertising and propaganda can be used for good or evil. Obviously it's used in, you know, in religion and mythology and it's today probably used more in the corporate world to sell you things than you really realize. The archetypal ideas of, you know, motherhood and family and fatherhood and what that means. And, you know, these different gods and goddesses represented as different characters in commercials or in films that are used to sell products and so on. So it's a really fascinating subject when you start getting into it. It's very powerful because it works on a level that's below conscious logical thought. And speaking of that, the interesting thing too is that Apollo is considered rationality, justice, music, but a very specific kind of very ordered music, poetry, logic. These are all Apollonian sort of ideals. And I don't know if you wanted to get into this yet. Do you want to talk about the 50s and 60s yet, or do you want to get into the context first?
Well, in the 50s and 60s kind of, you know, does set up the context for the actual, you know, lunar mission with Apollo. I can start out with the space program. How it goes from its inception to culminating at this point 50 years ago when the lunar lander set down on the moon. So NASA actually didn't begin until 1958, which was a very pivotal time in the space exploration concept for the entire world. But it started unofficially right after World War II. There was one of the best rocket scientists, he worked for the Germans at the time, Wernher von Braun, had taken rocketry specifically in the context of weaponry at the time, because that's what everyone was doing in a world war. We were all concerned with getting the better, bigger, faster. We were building big bombs. They were building rockets. So it's just what you do during war. And they really had advanced this technology, the funding and the labor to do so. And towards the end of the war, when it looked like surrender was imminent for the Germans, he and his staff, his huge staff of great scientists, were ordered to destroy all the parts, all the rockets, and more importantly, all the blueprints and data that they had really spent a lot of time collecting. Well, I guess as a safety valve, the story goes that Wernher von Braun and his workers actually took the hit everything in a coal mine or some sort of a deep mine, so that when the Americans came in and were capturing the prisoners of war and other players in the on the German side, that he was able to use that as a bargaining chip. And short story endless, he came to America through Operation Paperclip. And so not only did he survive and get to come to America and get a pretty good job and not get tried for war crimes, so did his staff and the equipment that was saved. 75 V-2 rockets made it to New Mexico for testing right after the war, and all the data and blueprints and plans that they had been working with. So our space program really kind of got a big jump start. But when the Russians, you know, got involved in the 50s, you know, with, you know, the atomic race, and then it became the space race. In 1958, that's when the Americans finally got up Explorer 1 at the end of January. And this was in response to the Russians sending up Sputnik in October of 57. And about midway through 1958, Congress passed the act that would then start the government agency, which we know now as NASA. So this was a very important time. And when it became a civilian branch of government and not part of the military, it's where some of the ideals we separated out from ballistic rockets and missiles being connected with space exploration and really made it more of a civilian, more of a humanitarian, perhaps, cause, or at least removed as much as we could the military
concept. What
could be a stigma, because that's just more enticing, more inciting, I guess, for for conflict or division or things like that. That we had a peaceful cause behind our mission. But very early on, this what became the NASA moon landing in 69 really started in 1958, maybe even in 1957. That it was going to be this graduated program, the first being Mercury. They were single occupants in the capsule. Mm-hmm. Then Gemini, as they like to make sure it's pronounced, had two pilots, astronaut occupants. And then with Apollo, there were three in the capsule. And this is reflected, talking about symbolism, in the mission patch for the entire Apollo program. There's the constellation Orion and the three belts, three stars in the belt. Maybe relate to the three astronauts in the capsule, but I'm sure there's a host of other, deeper and more meaningful symbolism involved there. So that's sort of how we got there. And politically, John Kennedy's speech about we would choose to go to the moon and do the other thing because it's hot, and we'll do so by the end of the decade. This rallying cry really got people interested in it, like as a culture. Wow, yeah. Here's something good we can do. You know, we have this technology. Here's a non-warring idea. It's exploration is in our DNA as human beings. I mean, Magellan, Columbus, Leif Erikson, I mean, you know, the whole world, is history has been marked by, and a lot of times it's an exploration of conquest. Let's be honest to ourselves, but this exploring and discovering a new land and reaching out, is so ingrained in who we are. And so that really, I think, helped, the public really get picked, I think that's, you know, picked up.
Yeah. And that's an interesting point because, I mean, I think that's the power of a mission, because I remember when we were talking about this before the show a few days, and you were talking about how, we, you know, the Russians were leading us in all ways prior to this, in their developments. And, you know, once you have this power of mission and you have a charismatic leader like a Kennedy behind it, then it becomes a directive, and it becomes a mission that everyone can get behind. And I know there's a little apocryphal tale of how Kennedy went to visit Houston, where they were developing the program. And he was actually in one of the offices there, and he was speaking to one of the janitors, and he asked him, you know, what he was working on. And the janitor told him, "I'm helping to put a man on the moon." And so, you know, everybody was on board with that idea, that mission. And that's, you know, that just a little side note, that's the power of mission and the power of vision and driving towards a unified goal. You know, as we say, or as it said in the Bible, you know, where there is no vision, the people perish. You know, and I think that's one of the challenges with today is getting everybody on board to say a cause, like, for example, dealing with some of the ecological challenges that we're facing, climate change and so forth. You know, there's no real clear mission or cause to move towards in some ways. I mean, there is definitely, you know, diverse groups that have ideas in that area, but there's no directive from the government. There's directive from governments that the United States doesn't want to be involved with because Europe is on a different course than we are. But, you know, it's something to think about, the power of a directive, the power of a mission. I just,
well, it was a very singular mission. It was very, I mean, simple in concept, very complicated to carry out.
But sure.
Put a
sure.
man on the moon and bring him back by the end of the decade. I mean, that's even the time frame.
It's very
you
clear.
Can say it in a sentence.
Yeah.
Well, as I mentioned, the kind of the brief history of the space program leading up to what put us in a position to send astronauts to the moon, and kind of link that to the Cold War and space race and arms race that the USSR and the USA were embroiled in. But there's even in America just alone, there was such a different there was a very strong cultural context from the 50s and the 60s also that was going on at the same time. And I can only imagine had, you know, a profound influence or also influenced by these happenings and going to the moons.
Getting back to what we were I was talking about a little bit earlier, kind of the difference between these sort of Apollonian sort of Apollo's point of view versus, you know, something that's kind of more moon oriented or, you know, what might be called quote unquote feminine or, you know, more connected sort of social cyclical sort of a viewpoint, you know, which the moon represents. But the Apollonian sort of viewpoint in a sense is what the United States was in the 1950s. I mean, Apollo as the sort of favorite son of Zeus, it's very representative of sort of the man in the gray flannel suit, the corporate man who would take orders and do what he was told. And there was a tremendous amount of pressure to, you know, keep one's lawn perfectly green and, you know, have the perfect family and put up this sort of front of perfection that fit into societal standards that, you know, we today probably have a hard time even understanding what that was all about. I mean, you have to talk to your parents or grandparents, you know, if you're younger, to understand what that might be like, because I mean, we live in a culture today where, you know, it's kind of like anything goes. I mean, it's certainly at least it's, you know, that's the unspoken rule. I mean, obviously we have rules, we have laws and so on, but in terms of the overall culture, it was much more uniform in the 50s, and that's very representative of Apollo. In fact, I want to read real quickly these Apollonian precepts. These were the sort of seven precepts by which followers of Apollo would live by. One of them, which is not on here, is actually know thyself. That's the first and most famous one, but it's not one of the seven precepts. That, I think, is kind of the ultimate precept, know thyself, which is over the temple, the Apollonian temple at Delphi. But these are as follows. So curb thy spirit is number one. Observe the limit, number two. Number three is hate hubris. Hubris is pride. Three, four is keep a reverent tongue. Five, fear authority. Six, bow before the divine. I got off track with those, with the numbering. I'm sorry. I'll stop numbering them and just read them. Glory not in strength. And then the last one is keep women under rule. And I think you could say that that really epitomizes the 1950s in a nutshell in a lot of ways. And these are, you know, Greek precepts from, you know, 3,000 years ago or something. Possibly older. So, you know, this is where we can see these archetypal ideas even playing out in our modern society in the 1950s. And then in this, going into the 60s, when this space program really gets steam, it's coming out of the 50s, and it's built certainly on a 50s mentality, sort of military industrial complex and the uniformity and patriotism and nationalism that was very strong in the 1950s in the United States. And coming out of World War II, it makes a lot of sense. I mean, we were on top of the world. Everything was destroyed. The United States was the only power standing. It makes sense that, you know, you would feel a sense of pride in that. In a way, I mean, on the other hand, I mean, we were lucky not to be damaged because no one attacked us and we weren't in the, you know, the field of conflict. So at any rate, that I think epitomizes the 1950s in a lot of ways. Going into the 60s, now, when this space program is occurring in the late 60s, I mean, society is shifting to a completely different point of view. And it's interesting that we're going to the moon. As I said, you know, the moon is a more feminine sort of a symbol in general. And feminism is coming to the forefront in the United States, and culture is changing, and women are standing up for their rights. Gay rights were coming to the forefront, civil rights, you know, the Black community were coming to the forefront. All of these changes where people were expecting to be taken seriously and to be given the rights that everyone else had. It was an interesting time, and in a lot of ways, it was the complete antithesis to that sort of Apollonian ideal of order and structure and law and justice and, you know, doing things in this measured way. And you would say, you know, it has a lot of more qualities of Dionysus to it in the 60s, which is very interesting. It's also, you know, connected to more feminine roots, definitely. So anyway, that's a kind of a contextualization of the 50s and 60s. And, you know, the space program obviously grew out of the 50s, and then it reaches its apotheosis and puts us on the moon in the 60s, which could be characterized as a more chaotic time in a way. So it's interesting to see those two things come together. In fact, you know, the Apollo is landing on the moon, and in a sense, you have a synthesis of masculine and feminine energy symbolized there. And then down here on Earth, the same thing is going on. I find that very fascinating.
That's a really great point and great observation. I hadn't really ever thought of it that way. Just like I said, from the beginning, I always had that question. It's like, well, why Apollo? Why a sun going to the moon? But in light of that symbolism, even if they weren't deliberately making the symbols say that, because they're so archetypal and because things are really kind of bigger than we are, that was definitely going on. And I love it. Now, I'll probably forever now think of the Apollo going to the moon, the masculine leaving this earth to, you know, the safety, to reach out, maybe a yearning towards just as the sun's rays reach out towards the moon so it can be reflected back, that there's this yearning for it, that I think it was larger than any government agency or any two government or global control or a huge and very well-funded program. I think the culture, maybe the collective unconscious, as well as what was happening in the culture. I think the birth control pill, the 67, 66, it was, you know, in that, and that was a very empowering watershed
moment. Connected to the moon because of the cycle and all of that.
Oh, yeah, the 28-day cycle.
It's very interesting when you start looking at it. And, you know, and you look at society in general, it's, you know, this patriarchal society is struggling to integrate a more feminine point of view at that time. And there's a lot of unrest, you know, social unrest and protest and all types of different movements going on. I mean, everybody in the 60s in some ways was just kind of going nuts. I mean, and not for no reason, but it certainly had a sort of Dionysian quality to it in the reveling and in Woodstock and the sort of orgiastic kind of, you know, things that played out in the music and so on. There was an interesting thing I just wanted to read real quick that I read in Jean Shinoda Bolen's book, Gods in Every Man. It's a fantastic book, by the way. This is a little quote from that. And this, you know, speaking of the 60s, obviously the 60s is known for music. We're getting a little off track, but it's indicative of society at the time and kind of in response to the 50s going into the 60s and so on, the 1950s going into the 1960s. But she says, in his music, Apollo was again associated with clarity and purity, in contrast to Dionysian music, which expresses chaos, ecstasy, turbulence, emotional conflict, and passion. Apollonian music values that clear note, the purity of music that is like higher mathematics, which brings harmony through time and measure and lifts the spirit. Bach in classical music echoes Apollo. Moderation and beauty were the essence and the effect of Apollo's music. It restrained all that was wild. So, you know, while you have this space program that's called Apollo, yet at the same time, the whole country is in this sort of Dionysian orgiastic revel that's very connected to the earth and the moon and the feminine. And, you know, it's a very great contrast that was taking place. And, you know, it requires, obviously what we're finding now is that we need a balance between these two things. You can't have one or the other exclusively. You need them in balance because, you know, you do need order and social regularity and law and so on, or you have a chaotic, unsafe society. But at the same time, if it goes too far, you have this horrific, tyrannical, you know, crushing sort of an oppressive situation. So there needs to be both. And I think that, you know, that was maybe the interesting thing is that, you know, from down below, we've got this, you know, on the earth, we've got this sort of Dionysian sort of feminine movement going on. And then up above, you know, the masculine is uniting with the moon. And that it's I find that pretty fascinating.
Oh, it's incredibly fascinating. And, you know, with that chaotic spirit of the 60s, music, you're right, everything in fashion, everything was counterculture. There were people doing things with their hair and their hemlines and whatnot and smoking things that were just, it was way, way out there. And we do need this balance because what really essentially happens is about every decade, we move in one direction and then we move too far in that direction. And then the next decade, we're going to go, well, we're going to clean that up and we're going to move everything over here now. And then that goes too far and then it moves back. And, you know, we're sort of playing this, you know, relentless ping pong that really doesn't leave much. Now, you have to have extremes, obviously, but it just seems like it goes from one to the other. The scale is tilting and then it tilts this way. And there's not a lot of equilibrium. But in in the 60s, you know, with all this going on, this, you know, the Vietnam War protests, you know, campuses were hotbeds of activity and activism and love-ins and, you know, the music stuff, the communes, this kind of communal living, but everyone doing their own thing and, you know, wanting to express themselves that way, and it really kind of being okay, at least the counterculture, which was really more powerful than the dominant culture, took over, said, yeah, it's okay, do this. But the one thing that did unite us all together, even President Nixon, you know, spoke with the astronauts and they landed on the moon, and we were all kind of okay with that, because we could, it's like the Olympics that happened every 4 years, and we could kind of put some of those other things aside, and we were all interested to some degree into what was happening.
Well, it becomes a unifying element. It becomes a mission that everybody can get on board with, right? And I think, you know, just to kind of move forward a little more quickly, because we are getting towards the end of the show, let's talk a little bit about the Earthrise photo and how that became kind of a unifying symbol.
That's exactly where I was going with this. About 7 months before the Apollo landing, it was over Christmas of 68, where the Apollo, I believe it was Apollo 8, I'll check myself on that, with Jim Lovell, the commander, went, it was a test mission. They weren't at all going to land on the moon, but they were going to go around the moon in their ship. And as they did, and they came around the other side, they could see the Earth rising up from even though they were above the moon, they were in orbit, it was still in the foreground, dominant in the foreground. And then the Earth, much, much smaller, the blue marble, rising up. And I think they quoted on live TV, they read from Genesis, the light and the dark were parted, the water and the sea were parted, and it was good. And the whole, you know, really the dominant Western creation myth for a lot of religions in Genesis, that at least, you know, a lot of people are familiar with, you know, was spoken. But here is this new aurora, this new dawn of a, and this image was so powerful that even the conspiracy theorists who think, well, maybe we didn't go to the moon, maybe it was aliens or something. At some point, even that doesn't matter as much, because although we had projected out and in paintings and in mythology for, you know, since the dawn of time about what it might be like to travel to the moon or a place beyond the stars, or at least outside of this Earth home in which we inhabit, this photograph, you know, really showed us that, yes, here's like kind of hard evidence that we are one people. We do live on this blue marble, out really kind of in the middle of outer space, and to see it from the perspective of another world, really, I think the consciousness of the culture, the world culture, historically, it was as big as the Copernican Revolution, where we went from being a geocentric to a heliocentric or a sun-centered solar system, and what that meant ethically and the religious response to that, and mm-hmm. really the resistance to the new idea. But it was also the dawn of, you know, the scientific age that was centered around that Copernican thing. So,
well, in some ways, that kind of distanced us, I would argue, from our connection to the Earth. Would you agree with that?
Well, it made Earth less significant. If we're at the center of the universe, yeah. Well, then, you know, God's eyes are upon us. But if we're just one little ball going around this big sun, and this is, you know, there's sun worship goes back. It's probably one of the oldest form of mm-hmm. Veneration. So it's as old as, and so I don't know if it's the sun worshipers versus the moon worshipers, at this point we have going on. But so here it is, this amazing and expensive and dangerous technological achievement that was not at all environmentally friendly, I'm sure, to get this pictured and to see, you know, the Earth from the moon is really a symbol of, you know, technology and everything that's good about it. Mm-hmm. Yet at the same time, that image was used by environmentalists and hippies, and going on through the 70s, it was even the cover of the Whole Earth catalog, that, you know, here, oh, we have such a precious planet. Here's something that we need to protect. So really all these different, you know, sides of the equation, if you will, coming together to and through this image, maybe looking at it in different ways, but it's undeniable that it does show a technological achievement, as well as it does promote an environmental call to action.
Definitely. And I think that's one of the interesting things that came out of seeing that view, is I think people be able to conceptualize that the planet that we live on, and it's hard to see it because it seems so vast to us. We look up into the sky and it seems to be, you know, endless. We can see out into space, we can see the stars, but to get the view from outside looking down upon the planet, you can see then, becomes very clear, very apparent, that what we basically live on is a big giant snow globe. It's a closed system. You know, it's a big round ball. And you know, anything we do on this planet stays within the atmosphere. So it's a closed system for the most part. Obviously we can go out of it and we can come back into it, and it's a porous sort of a closed system. But in essence though, you know, it is a little round ball, like a little, you know, ecosphere, for lack of a better word, you know, because I mean that's really what it is, that is very fragile. And, you know, I think it became very apparent to people when they saw that image. It's like, wait a minute, you know, all the pollution that we're pumping into the air, all the stuff we're dumping into the rivers and oceans, all of the garbage that we're creating, it goes somewhere. It doesn't just, you know, go off into the ether. It goes somewhere on this little round planet, and everything is connected and everything circulates around. And I think sometimes today we still forget that because it seems so large. We'll just send it off to a landfill, or we'll just send it off to China for processing, or we'll send it to India for them to recycle it, or, you know, whatever. It seems like it's somewhere else, but there is nowhere else. It's a closed system. And that's the thing we have to remember. And that message, I think, really came forward in the ecological movements of the 60s and 70s, and the Back to the Earth movements and so on. And like you said, the, you know, Mother Earth News came out, and the Whole Earth Catalog, and there was a whole movement to, you know, to go back to nature in a lot of ways and live in more balance with nature. And I think that that's still a relevant ideal. Obviously technology is important. Obviously we live in an advanced world and most of us live in cities, but there are things we can do to live in connection with Mother Earth in a much more balanced way. And, you know, that, and that image, I think, helps us to remember that, helps us to remember that. So a couple of the takeaways, I think, from today's show, I'm just going to wrap it up because we're getting towards the end of it. I'll let you kind of wrap it when I'm done. But think about mission, the value of mission, the value of balance between masculine and feminine energy, Apollo, Dionysus, Apollo and Artemis, sun and the moon, and some of these different things. We have actually a podcast that we did on the reconciliation of the opposites. That's a nice introduction to that as well. So check that out if you get a chance. And then just seeing things in a more mythological context, looking at the Earth as a closed system, and remembering that, you know, where we, you know, when we throw something away, or when we flush something down the toilet, or when we try to get rid of anything of any sorts, it goes somewhere else. We are on a closed planet, and we all have to remember that and try to do our best in terms of living in balance with the delicate system that we live with. And you know, looking at pictures like that of the Earth, Earthrise, and I know Chris is going to put up a great photo in the video, is a good way to remember that. Meditating on that idea, the one planet. You know, and that's the other thing, the one planet, you know, we're all nations on this one planet. So we've got to figure out ways to get along, right? So there you go. So Chris, go ahead and any closing thoughts you have, share those, and then we'll wrap it up.
Well, sure. I'll just piggyback on what you just said. And I think that really is the important thing. And I hope that becomes part of the consciousness here at this 50th anniversary. I'm really aware, and through our discussion, become really just knowledgeable at how significant it is to see the Earth. We kind of take it for granted now. We have globes and, you know, pictures of space. It's like, so what? But if we can maybe return to that, because unfortunately, what I'm hearing in some of the space circles are that, well, we got to get to Mars. Because Mars, you know, we're going to run out of our resources here, and we got to get to Mars, so that'll be our place to live, you know, when we destroy the Earth. It's like, but we'll probably just destroy Mars too. If you know, don't take that attitude, you know, let's hold on before we go to Mars. Let's take care of things here, and maybe bring that attitude
Yeah, what Jesus said, get the speck out of your own eye before you try to get the mote out of the other guy's eye, I think is how it was, or whatever. You know, and we need to put our own house in order before we go trying to abandon this place that we know that we can live on to go crap some other place up. I mean, that's just common sense.
All right. Well, I'm sure we could talk for a long time about that.
Yeah, especially our human foibles. We could speak for hours to that subject. And there's also the
inner aspect too. You know, the sun and the moon, that we have those qualities in ourselves. Mm-hmm. So if we can look at our own lives as being the earth, that let's take care of our own environment, our own. And I like the, I think it's a term you coined, this envirosphere. I really like it.
I did not say that, but thank you for crediting me with
that.
I just said ecosphere. But
ecosphere, okay.
But I love it. You know, I think envirosphere is even better. I think we invented a new corporation, Envirosphere Incorporated. So
LLC.
LLC. And we'll make it one of these social benefit companies. All right. Anyway, so that is our show for today. Thank you very much, Chris. You did a beautiful job of hosting that and enlightening us about the landing. So the landing actually was July 20th, 1969, right? July 20th?
Yeah, correct.
Okay. So happy 50th anniversary of moon landing. And let's take our hats off to the men and women that were involved with that program and put us on the moon. It's an impressive feat. And there's also some great symbolic meaning to it as well. So thank you for joining us today on the Cosmic Eye Show. We hope you have a great week. We are here every Sunday. And like we said, please support us if you can. We're at anchor.fm/cosmiceye. Support Chris's book and my book as well, if you can. So Chris's book is The Spirit in the Sky, and mine is If You Can Worry, You Can Meditate. Thanks again for showing up and supporting us. Goodbye and God bless. See you next week.